An acolyte, someone to nurture. Shallan suspected that was at least partly because Tin liked having someone around to impress. Her life must be so lonely, Shallan thought. Always moving, always taking whatever she can get but never giving, except once in a while, to a young thief she can foster. A strange shadow moved across the wall of the tent. Pattern, though Shallan only noticed him because she knew what to look for. He could be practically invisible when he wanted to be, though unlike some Spren, he could not vanish completely. The Span Reed continued to write, giving Tin a longer rundown of conditions in various countries. After that, it produced a curious statement. "I have checked with informants at the Shattered Plains," the pen wrote. "The ones you asked after are indeed wanted men. Most are former members of the army of High Prince Sadius. He is not forgiving of deserters." "What's this?" Shallan asked, rising from her stool and going to look more closely at what the pen wrote. "I implied earlier we'd have to discuss this," Tin said, changing the paper for the span read. "As I keep explaining, the life we lead requires doing some harsh things. The leader, whom you call Vatha, is worth a bounty of 4 emerald bromes," the pen wrote. "The rest, 2 bromes each." "Bounty?" Shallan demanded. "I gave promises to these men."
"Hush," Tin said. "We're not alone in this camp, fool child. If you want us dead, all you need to do is let them overhear this conversation."
"We're not turning them in for money," Shallan said more softly. "Tin, I gave my word."
"Your word?" Tin said, laughing. "Kid, what do you think we are? Your word?"
Shallan blushed. On the table, the span reed continued to write, oblivious to the fact they weren't paying attention. It was saying something about a job Tin had done before. "Tin," Shallan said, "Vatha and his men can be useful." Tin shook her head, walking over to the side of the tent, pouring herself a cup of wine.
"You should be proud of what you did here. You have barely any experience, yet you took over 3 separate groups, convincing them to put you, practically sphereless and completely without authority, in charge. Brilliant. But here's the thing. The lies we tell, the dreams we create, they're not real. We can't let them be real.
This might be the hardest lesson you have to learn." She turned to Shallan, her expression having gone hard, all sense of relaxed playfulness gone.
"When a good con woman dies, it's usually because she starts believing her own lies. She finds something good and wants it to continue. She keeps it going, thinking she can juggle it. One day more, she tells herself. One day more, and then..."
Tin dropped the cup. It hit the ground, the wine splashing blood red across the tent floor and Tin's rug. "Red carpet. Once it was white." "Your rug," Shallan said, feeling numb.
"You think I can afford to haul a rug with me when I leave the Shattered Plains?" Tin asked softly, stepping across the spilled wine, taking Shallan by the arm. "You think we can take any of this? It's meaningless. You've lied to these men. You've built yourself up. And tomorrow, when we enter that war camp, the truth will hit you like a slap in the face. You think you can actually get clemency for these men? From a man like High Prince Sadius? Don't be an idiot. Even if you get the con going with Dalinar, you want to spend what little credibility we can fake in order to free murderers from Dalinar's political enemy? How long did you think you could keep this lie going?"
Shallan sat back down on the stool, agitated, both at Tin and at herself. She shouldn't be surprised that Tin wanted to betray Vatha and his men. She knew what Tin was, and had eagerly let the woman teach her. In truth, Vatha and his men probably did deserve their punishments. That didn't mean Shallan was going to betray them. She had told them they could change. She had given her word. Lies. Just because you learned how to lie didn't mean you had to let the lie rule you. But how could she protect Vatha without alienating Tin? Did she even have that option? What would Tin do when Shallan proved to actually be the woman betrothed to Dalinar Kolin's son? How long did you think you could keep this lie going?
Here now, Tin said, smiling broadly. That's some good news.
Shallan shook herself from her ruminations, glancing at what the span read had been writing. In regards to your mission in Amidlaten, it read, our benefactors have written to say that they are pleased. They do want to know if you recovered the information, but I think this is secondary to them. They let slip that they've found the information they need elsewhere, something about a city they've been researching. For your part, there is no news of the target surviving. It seems that your worry about the mission's failure is unfounded. Whatever happened aboard the ship, it worked to our favor. The Wind's Pleasure is reported lost with all hands. Yasna Kolin is dead.
Yasna Kolin is dead.
Shallan gaped, jaw dropping.
That, it isn't.
Maybe those idiots did manage to complete the job, Tin said, satisfied. It looks like I'll be paid after all.
Your mission in Amidlaten, Shallan whispered. It was to assassinate Yasna Kolin.
Run the operation, at least, Tin said, distracted. Would have gone myself, but can't stand ships. Those churning seas turn my stomach inside out.
Shallan couldn't speak. Tin was an assassin. Tin had been behind the hit on Yasna Kolin. The span read was still writing. Some interesting news. You asked after House Davar in Yarkaved. It looks like Yasna, before leaving Karbranth, took a new ward. Shallan reached for the span read. Tin caught her hand, the woman's eyes widening as the read wrote a few last sentences. A girl named Shallan. Red hair, pale skin. Nobody knows much about her. Didn't seem important news to our informants until I pried.
Shallan looked up just as Tin did, meeting the woman's eyes.
Ah, damnation, Tin said.
Shallan tried to pull free. Instead, she found herself being hauled off the chair. She couldn't follow Tin's quick motions as the woman slammed her to the ground face first. The woman's boot followed to Shallan's back, knocking the air from her and throwing a shock through her body. Shallan's vision fuzzed as she gasped for air.
Damnation! Damnation! Tin said. You're Kolin's ward? Where's Yasna? Did she live?
Help!
Shallan croaked, barely able to speak as she tried to crawl toward the tent wall. Tin knelt on Shallan's back, pressing the air from her lungs again.
I had my men clear the area around this tent. I was worried about you alerting the deserters that we would turn them in. Stormfather!
She knelt down, head closer to Shallan's ear. As Shallan struggled, Tin grabbed her on the shoulder and squeezed hard.
Did Yasna live?
No,
Shallan whispered, tears of pain coming to her eyes.
The ship, you may have noticed, Yasna's voice said from behind them, has two very fine cabins which I hired out for us at no small expense.
Tin cursed, leaping up and spinning to see who had spoken. It was, of course, Pattern. Shallan didn't give him a glance but scrambled toward the tent wall. Vatha and the others were out there somewhere. If she could just...
Tin caught her leg, yanking her backward. I can't escape,
a primal part of her thought. Panic surged within Shallan, bringing with it memories of days spent completely impotent, her father's increasingly destructive violence, a family falling apart. Powerless. Can't run, can't run, can't run.
Fight!
Shallan pulled her leg free of Tin and spun, launching herself at the woman.
She would not be powerless again. She would not!
Tin gasped as Shallan attacked with everything she had, a clawing, angry, frantic mess. It wasn't effective. Shallan knew next to nothing about how to fight.
and in moments she found herself croaking in pain a second time, Tin's fist buried in her stomach. Shallan sank to her knees, tears on her cheeks. She tried, ineffectively, to inhale. Tin cracked her on the side of the head, making her vision go all white. "Where did that come from?" Tin said. Shallan blinked, looking up, vision swimming. She was on the ground again. Her fingernails had left a set of bloody rips across Tin's cheek. Tin reached up, hand coming away red. Her expression darkened, and she reached to the table where her sword rested in its sheath.
"What a mess," Tin growled. "Storm it. I'm going to have to invite that Vatha here, then find a way to blame this on him."
Tin pulled the sword from its sheath. Shallange struggled to her knees, then tried to climb to her feet, but her legs were unsteady and the room lurched around her, as if she were still on the ship.
"Pattern," she croaked. "Pattern!"
She heard something outside. Shouts?
"I'm sorry," Tin said, voice cold. "I'm going to have to tie this up tight. In a way, I'm proud of you. You fooled me. You'd have been good at this."
"Calm," Shallan told herself. "Be calm." 10 heartbeats. But for her, it didn't have to be 10, did it? No, it must be. Time. I need time. She had spheres in her sleeve. As Tin approached, Shallan breathed in sharply. Stormlight became a raging tempest inside of her, and she raised her hand, thrusting out a pulse of light. She couldn't form it into anything. She still didn't know how. But it seemed for a moment to show a rippling image of Shallan, standing proudly like a woman of the court. Tin stopped short at the sight of the projection of light and color, then waved her sword out in front of her. The light rippled, dissipating into smoky trails.
"So I'm going mad," Tin said, "hearing voices, seeing things. I guess part of me doesn't want to do this."
She advanced, raising her blade.
"I'm sorry that you have to learn the lesson this way. Sometimes we must do things we don't like, kid. Difficult things."
Shallan growled, thrusting her hands forward. Mist twisted and writhed in her hands as a brilliantly silver blade formed there, spearing Tin through the chest. The woman barely had time to gasp in surprise as her eyes burned in her skull. Tin's corpse slid back off the weapon, collapsing in a heap.
"Difficult things," Shallan growled. "Yes, I believe I told you. I've learned that lesson already. Thank you."
She crawled to her feet, wobbling. The tent flap ripped open, and Shallan turned, holding up the shard blade point first toward the opening. Vatha, Gaz, and a few other soldiers stopped there in a jumble, weapons bloodied. They looked from Shallan to the corpse on the floor with its burned-out eyes, then back to Shallan. She felt numb. She wanted to dismiss the blade, hide it. It was terrible. She did not. She crushed those emotions and hid them deep within. At the moment, she needed something strong to hold to, and the weapon served that purpose, even if she hated it.
"Tin's soldiers?"
Was that her voice? Completely cold? Purged of emotion?
"Stormfather,"
Vatha said, stepping into the tent, hand to his chest as he stared at the shard blade.
"That night when you pled with us, you could have killed us every one, and the bandits too. You could have done it on your own." "Tin's men!"
Shallan shouted.
"Dead, Brightness," Red said. "We heard a voice, telling us to come get you, and they wouldn't let us pass. Then we heard you screaming and..."
"Was it the voice of the Almighty?"
Vatha asked in a whisper.
"It was my spren," Shallan said. "That is all you need know. Search this tent. This woman was hired to assassinate me."
It was true, after a fashion. There might be records of who hired her.
"Bring me anything you find with writing on it."
As they swarmed in and set to work, Shallan sat down on the stool beside the table. The span reed still waited there, hovering, paused at the bottom of the page. It needed a new sheet. Shallan dismissed the shard blade. "Do not speak of what you saw here to the others," she told Vatha and his men. Though they promised quickly, she doubted that would hold for long. Shard blades were near mythical objects, and a woman holding one? Rumors would spread. Just what she needed. "You're alive because of that cursed thing," she thought to herself. "Again. Stop complaining." She took the span reed up and changed the paper, then set it with its point at the corner. After a moment, Tin's distant accomplice started writing again. "Your benefactors on the Amidlaten job wish to meet with you," the pen wrote. "It seems that the Ghostbloods have something else for you to do. Would you like me to arrange a meeting with them in the war camps?" The pen stopped in place, waiting for a response. What had the span reed said above? That these people, Tin's benefactors, the Ghostbloods, had found the information they sought. Information about a city.
Yirithiru.
The people who had killed Yasna, the people who threatened her family, were searching for the city too. Shallan stared at the paper and its words for an extended moment as Vatha and his men began pulling clothing out of Tin's trunk, knocking on its sides to find anything hidden. "Would you like me to arrange a meeting with them?" Shallan took the span reed, switched the fabrial's setting, then wrote a single word. "Yes." The end of part 2. Interludes. Eshenai. Zael. Taln. I-5. The Rider of Storms. In the city of Narak, people closed up windows tightly as night approached and the storm loomed. They stuffed rags under doors, shoved bracing boards into position, pounded large square blocks of wood into windows. Eshenai did not join in the preparations, but stood outside Thud's dwelling, listening to his report. He just returned from meeting with the Alethi, arranging a parley to discuss peace. She had wanted to send someone earlier, but the five had deliberated and complained until Eshenai wanted to throttle the lot of them. At least they'd finally agreed to let her send a messenger.
7 days, Thud said. The meeting will happen on a neutral plateau.
Did you see him?
Eshenai asked, eager.
The Blackthorn?
Thud shook his head.
What of the other one? Eshenai asked. The Surgebinder?
No sign of him either.
Thud looked troubled. He looked eastward.
You'd better go. I can give you more details after the storm is done.
Eshenai nodded, resting her hand on her friend's shoulder.
Thank you. Good luck, Thud said to Resolve.
To all of us, she replied, as he shut the door, leaving her alone in a dark, seemingly empty city.
Eshenai checked the storm shield on her back, then took the sphere with Venli's captive Spren from her pocket and attuned the rhythm of Resolve. The time had come. She ran toward the storm. Resolve was a stately beat with a steady rising sense of import and power. She left Narak, and reaching the first chasm, she jumped. Only Warform had the strength for such leaps. For the workers to reach outer plateaus and grow food, they used rope bridges that were pulled back and stowed before each storm. She landed in full stride, her footsteps falling to the beat of Resolve. The storm wall appeared in the distance, barely visible in the darkness. Winds rose, pushing against her as if to hold her back. Above, windsprens zipped and danced in the air. They were heralds of what was to come. Eshenai jumped 2 more chasms, then slowed, striding up to the top of a low hill. The storm wall now dominated the night sky, advancing at a terrible pace. The enormous sheet of darkness mingled debris with rain, a banner of water, rock, dust, and fallen plants, Eshinai unhooked the large shield on her back. For the listeners, there was a certain romanticism to going out in the storm. Yes, the storms were terrible, but every listener would have to spend a number of nights out in them alone. The songs said that someone seeking a new form would be protected. She wasn't certain if this was fancy or fact, but the songs didn't prevent most listeners from hiding in a cleft of rock to avoid the storm wall, then coming out once it had passed. Eshinai preferred a shield. It felt more like facing the rider straight on. This one, the soul of the storm, was the one the humans called Storm Father, and he was not one of her people's gods. In fact, the songs named him a traitor, a Spren who had chosen to protect humans instead of the listeners. Still, her people respected him. He would kill any who did not respect him. She placed the base of her shield against a ridge of rock on the ground, then turned her shoulder against it, lowered her head, and braced herself with one foot back. Her other hand held the stone with the Spren in it. She'd have preferred to wear her plate, but for some reason, having it on interfered with the transformation process. She felt and heard the storm approach. The ground shook. The air roared. Bits of leaves swept across her in a chill gust, like scouts before an oncoming army that charged behind, the howling wind its battle cry. She squeezed her eyes shut. It slammed against her. Despite her posture and her braced muscles, something cracked against the shield and flipped it away. The wind caught it and ripped it from her fingers. She stumbled backward, then threw herself to the ground, shoulder to the wind, head ducked. Thunder beat against her as the raging wind tried to pull her off the plateau and toss her into the air. She kept her eyes closed, as all was black within the storm save for the flashes of lightning. It did not seem to her she was being protected. Her shoulder against the wind, huddling down behind a hillock, it seemed that the wind was doing its best to destroy her. Rocks crunched against the dark plateau nearby, shaking the ground. All she could hear was the roar of wind in her ears, punctuated occasionally by thunder. A terrible song without rhythm. She kept resolve attuned inside of her. She could feel that, at least, even if she couldn't hear. Rain that fell like arrowheads beat into her body, bouncing off her skull plate and her armor. She set her jaw against the deep, bone-chilling cold and stayed in place. She had done this many times before, either when transforming or when on the occasional surprise raid against the Alethi. She could survive. She would survive. She focused on the rhythm in her head, clinging to some rocks as the wind tried to push her back off the plateau. Demid, Venli's once mate, had started a movement where people who wanted to transform waited inside buildings until the storm had been going for a while. They only stepped out once the initial burst of fury was past. That was risky, as you never knew when the point of transformation would come. Eshinai had never tried it. The storms were violent, they were dangerous, but they were also things of discovery. Within them, the familiar became something grand, majestic, and terrible. She did not look forward to entering them, but when she had to, she always found the experience thrilling. She lifted her head, eyes closed, and put her face to the winds, feeling them blast her, shake her. She felt the rain on her skin. The rider of storms was a traitor, yes, but you could not have a traitor who had not originally been a friend. These storms belonged to her people. The listeners were of the storms. The rhythms changed in her mind. In a moment, they all aligned and became the same. No matter which one she attuned, she heard the same rhythm, single, steady beats, like that of a heart. The moment had arrived. The storm vanished. Wind, rain, sound, gone. Eshinai stood up, dripping wet, her muscles cold, her skin numb. She shook her head, spraying water, and looked up into the sky. The face was there, infinite, expansive, The humans spoke of their storm father, yet they never knew him as a listener did. As wide as the sky itself, with eyes full of countless stars. The gemstone in Eshenai's hand burst alight. Power. Energy. She imagined it coursing through her, energizing her, enlivening her. Eshenai threw the gemstone against the ground, smashing it and releasing the spren. She worked hard to get the proper feel down, as Venli had trained her.
"Is this really what you want?"
The voice reverberated through her like crashing thunder. The rider had spoken to her. That happened in songs, but not... never. She attuned appreciation, but of course it was the same rhythm now. Beat, beat, beat. The spren escaped from its prison and spun around her, giving off a strange red light. Splinters of lightning sprang from it. Anger spren? This was wrong.
"I suppose this must be," the Stormfather said. "It was going to happen."
"No," Eshenai said, stepping back from that spren. In a moment of panic, she cast from her mind the preparations that Venli had given her. "No!" The spren became a streak of red light and hit her in the chest. Tendrils of red spread outward.
"I cannot stop this," the Stormfather said. "I would shelter you, little one, if I were given that power. I am sorry."
Eshenai gasped, the rhythms fleeing her mind, and fell to her knees. She felt it wash through her. The transformation.
"I am sorry."
The rains came again, and her body began to change.
I-6 Zael. Someone was near. Zael awoke, snapping his eyes open, knowing instantly that someone was approaching his room. Blast. It was the middle of the night. If this was another light-eyed brat he'd turned away, come to beg... He grumbled to himself, climbing off his cot. "I am far, far too old for this." He pulled open his door, revealing the courtyard of the practice grounds at night. The air was wet. Oh, right. One of those storms had come, invested to the hilt and looking for a place to stick it all. Cursed things. A young man, hand poised to knock, jumped back in surprise from the opening door. Kaladin. The bridge man turned bodyguard. The one with that spren Zael could sense always spinning about.
"You look like death itself," Zael snapped at the boy.
Kaladin's clothing was bloodied, his uniform ripped up on one side. The right sleeve was missing.
"What happened?"
"Attempt on the king's life," the boy said softly. "Not 2 hours ago."
"Huh.
Is your offer to learn how to fight a shard blade still good?"
"No."
Zael slammed the door. He turned to walk back toward his cot. The boy pushed the door open, of course. Blasted monks. Saw themselves as property and couldn't own anything, so they figured they didn't need locks on the doors.
"Please," the boy said. "I..." "Kid," Zael said, turning back toward him. "Two people live in this room."
The boy frowned, looking at the single cot.
"The first," Zael said, "is a grouchy old swordsman who has a soft spot for kids who are in over their heads. He comes out by day. The other is a very, very grouchy swordsman who finds everything and everyone utterly contemptible. He comes out when some fool wakes him at a horrid hour of the night. I suggest you ask the first man and not the second. All right?"
"All right," the boy said. "I'll be back."
"Good,"
Zael said, settling down on the bed.
"And don't be green from the ground."
The boy paused by the door. "Don't be... huh?" "Stupid language," Zael thought, climbing into his cot.
No proper metaphors at all. Just leave your attitude and come to learn. I hate beating up people younger than me. It makes me feel like a bully.
The kid grunted, sliding the door shut. Zyle pulled up his blanket. Damn monks only got one, and turned over on his cot. He expected a voice to speak in his mind as he drifted off. Of course, there wasn't one. Hadn't been one in years. I-7 Taln. Of fires that burned, and yet they were gone. Of heat he could feel when others felt not. Of screams his own that nobody heard. Of torture sublime, for life it meant.
He just stares like that, Your Majesty.
Words.
He doesn't seem to see anything. Sometimes he mumbles, sometimes he shouts. But always he just stares.
The gift and words. Not his, never his. Now his.
Storms, it's haunting, isn't it? I'd ride all this way with that, Your Majesty. Listening to him ranting in the back of the wagon half the time, then feeling him stare at the back of my head the rest.
And Wit, you mentioned him.
Started on the trip with me, Your Majesty. But on the second day, he declared that he needed a rock.
A rock?
Yes, Your Majesty. He hopped out of the wagon and found one. Then, he hit himself on the head with it, Your Majesty. Did it 3 or 4 times. Came right back to the wagon with an odd grin and said,
Yes?
Well, he said that he'd needed, I had this remembered for you. He said, I needed an objective frame of reference by which to judge the experience of your company. Somewhere between 4 and 5 blows, I place it. I don't rightly understand what he meant, sir. I think he was mocking me.
Safe bet.
Why didn't they scream? The heat of death. Of death and the dead and the dead and their talking and not screaming of death except of the death that did not come.
After that, Your Majesty, Wit just kind of, well, ran off. Into the hills. Like some storming horn-eater.
Don't try to understand, Wit, Borden. You'll only cause yourself pain.
Yes, Bright Lord.
I like this, Wit.
We're quite aware, Elokar.
Honestly, Your Majesty, I preferred the madman for company.
Well, of course you did. If people liked to be around Wit, he wouldn't be much of a wit, would he?
They were on fire. The walls were on fire. The floor was on fire. Burning. And the inside of her cannot where to be and then at all.
Where?
A trip. Water? Wheels? Fire. Yes, fire.
Can you hear me, madman?
Elokar, look at him. I doubt he understands. I am Talanal Elin, herald of war.
Voice. He spoke it. He didn't think it. The words came like they always came.
What was that? Speak louder, man.
The time of the return, the desolation, is near at hand. We must prepare. You will have forgotten much, following the destruction of the times past. I can make out some of it, Elokar. It's Alethi. Northern accent, not what I'd have expected from one with such dark skin.
Where did you get the shard blade, madman? Tell me. Most blades are accounted for through the generations, their lineage and history recorded. This one is completely unknown. From whom did you take it?
Kalak will teach you to cast bronze if you have forgotten this. We will soul cast blocks of metal directly for you. I wish we could teach you steel, but casting is so much easier than forging, and you must have something we can produce quickly. Your stone tools will not serve against what is to come.
He said something about bronze. And stone?
Videl can train your surgeons,
and Jezreon, he will teach you leadership. So much is lost between returns.
The shard blade, where did you get it?
How did you separate it from him, Borden?
We didn't, Bright Lord. He just dropped it.
And it didn't vanish away? Not bonded, then? He couldn't have had it for long. Were his eyes this color when you found him?
Yes, sir. A dark-eyed man with a shard blade. Odd sight, that.
I will train your soldiers. We should have time. Ishar keeps talking about a way to keep information from being lost following desolations. And you have discovered something unexpected. We will use that. Surge binders to act as guardians. Knights.
He's said this all before, Your Majesty. When he mumbles, he just keeps at it, over and over. I don't think he even knows what he's saying. Eerie how his expression doesn't change as he talks.
That is an Alethi accent.
He looks like he's been living in the wild for some time, with that long hair and those broken nails. Perhaps a villager lost their mad father.
And the blade Elokar?
Surely you don't think it's his, Uncle?
The coming days will be difficult, but with training, humanity will survive. You must bring me to your leaders. The other heralds should join us soon.
I am willing to consider anything these days. Your Majesty, I suggest you send him to the Ardens. Perhaps they can help his mind to recover.
What will you do with the shard blade?
I am certain we can find a good use for it. In fact, something occurs to me right now. I might have need of you, Borden.
Whatever you need, Bright Lord.
I think I am late. This time. How long had it been?
2 long.
I-8. A form of power. They were waiting for Eshenai when she returned. A gathering of thousands crowded the edge of the plateau just outside of Narak. Workers, nimbles, soldiers, and even some mates, who had been drawn away from their hedonism by the prospect of something novel. A new form. A form of power? Eshenai strode toward them, marveling at the energy. Tiny, almost invisible lines of red lightning flared from her hand if she made a fist quickly. Her marbled skin tone, mostly black, with a slight grain of red streaks, had not changed, but she'd lost the bulky armor of warform. Instead, small ridges peeked out through the skin of her arms, which was stretched tightly in places. She tested the new armor against stones and found it very durable. She had hair strands again. How long had it been since she'd felt those? More wondrous, she felt focused. No more worries about the fate of her people. She knew what to do. Venli pushed to the front of the crowd as Eshenai reached the edge of the chasm. They looked across the void at one another, and Eshenai could see the question on her sister's lips. It worked? Eshenai leapt the chasm. She didn't require the running start that Warform used. She crouched down, then threw herself up and into the air. The wind seemed to writhe around her. She shot over the chasm and landed among her people, red lines of power running up her legs as she crouched, absorbing the impact of the landing. People backed away. So clear. Everything was so clear. "I have returned from the storms," she said to Praise, which could also be used for true satisfaction. "I bring with me the future of two peoples. Our time of loss is at an end." "Eshenai?" It was Thud, wearing his long coat. "Eshenai, your eyes." "Yes, they're red. They are a representation of what I've become." "But in the songs..." "Sister!" Eshenai called to Resolve.
Come look upon what you have wrought.
Venli approached, timid at first. Storm form, she whispered to Awe. It works then? You can move in the storms without danger?
More than that, Eshenai said. The winds obey me. And Venli, I can feel something. Something building. A storm.
You feel a storm right now, in the rhythms?
Beyond the rhythms, Eshenai said.
How could she explain it? How could she describe taste to one with no mouth? Sight to one who had never seen?
I feel a tempest brewing just beyond our experience. A powerful, angry tempest. A high storm. With enough of us bearing this form together, we could bring it. We could bend the storms to our will, and could bring them down upon our enemies.
Humming to the rhythm of Awe spread through those who watched. As they were listeners, they could feel the rhythm, hear it. All were in tune, all were in rhythm with one another. Perfection.
Eshenai held out her arms to the sides and spoke in a loud voice. Cast aside despair, and sing to the rhythm of joy. I have looked into the depths of the Storm Rider's eyes, and I have seen his betrayal. I know his mind, and have seen his intent to help the humans against us. But my sister has discovered salvation. With this form we can stand on our own, independent, and we can sweep our enemies from this land like leaves before the tempest.
The humming to Awe grew louder, and some began to sing. Eshenai gloried in it. She pointedly ignored the voice deep within her that was screaming in horror.
Part 3. Deadly. Shallan. Kaladin. Adolin. Navani.
35. The multiplied strain of simultaneous infusion. They also, when they had settled their rulings in the nature of each bond's placement, called the name of it the Nael Bond, with regard to its effect upon the souls of those caught in its grip. In this description, each was related to the bonds that drive Roshar itself. 10 surges, named in turn, and 2 for each order. In this light it can be seen that each order would by necessity share 1 surge with each of its neighbors. From Words of Radiance, Chapter 8, page 6. Adolin threw his shard blade. Wielding the weapons was about more than just practicing stances and growing accustomed to the 2-light swordplay. A master of the blade learned to do more with the bond. He learned to command it to remain in place after being dropped, and learned to summon it back from the hands of those who might have picked it up. He learned that man and sword were, in some ways, one. The weapon became a piece of your soul. Adolin had learned to control his blade in this way. Usually. Today the weapon disintegrated almost immediately after leaving his fingers. The long, silvery blade transmuted to white vapor, holding its shape for just a brief moment, like a smoke ring, before exploding in a puff of writhing white streams. Adolin growled in frustration, pacing back and forth on the plateau, hand held out to the side as he resummoned the weapon. 10 heartbeats. At times, it felt like an eternity. He wore his plate without the helm, which sat atop a rock nearby, and so his hair blew free in the early morning breeze. He needed the plate. His left shoulder and side were a mass of purple bruises. His head still ached from slamming into the ground during the assassin's attack last night. Without the plate, he wouldn't be nearly so nimble today. Besides, he needed its strength. He kept looking over his shoulder, expecting the assassin to be there. He'd stayed up all night last night, sitting on the floor outside his father's room, wearing plate, arms crossed on his knees, chewing ridge bark to stay awake. He'd been caught without his plate once. Not again. And what will you do? He thought to himself as his blade reappeared. Wear it all the time? The part of him that asked such questions was rational. He didn't want to be rational right now. He shook the condensation from his blade, then twisted and hurled it, transmitting the mental commands that would tell it to hold together. Once again, the weapon shattered to mist moments after it left his fingers. It didn't even cross half the distance to the rock formation he was aiming for. What was wrong with him? He'd mastered blade commands years ago. True, he hadn't often practiced throwing his sword. Such things were forbidden in duels, and he hadn't ever thought he'd need to use the maneuver. That was before he'd been trapped on the ceiling of a hallway, unable to properly engage an assassin. Adolin walked to the edge of the plateau, staring out over the uneven expanse of the shattered plains. A huddle of three guards watched him nearby. Laughable. What would three bridgemen do if the assassin in white returned? Kaladin was worth something in the attack, Adolin thought. More than you were. That man had been suspiciously effective. Renarin said that Adolin was unfair toward the bridgeman captain, but there was something strange about that man. More than his attitude, the way he always acted like by talking to you he was doing you a favor. The way he seemed so decidedly gloomy at everything, angry at the world itself. He was unlikable, plain and simple, but Adolin had known plenty of unlikable people. Kaladin was also strange, in ways Adolin couldn't explain. Well, for all that, Kaladin's men were just doing their duty. No use in snapping at them, so he gave them a smile. Adolin's short blade dropped into his fingers again, too light for its size. He had always felt a certain strength when holding it. Never before had Adolin felt powerless when bearing his shards. Even surrounded by the Parshendi, even certain he was going to die, he'd still felt power. Where was that feeling now? He spun and threw the weapon, focusing as Zael had taught him years before, sending a direct instruction to the blade, picturing what he needed it to do. It held together, spinning end over end, flashing in the air. It sank up to its hilt into the stone of the rock formation. Adolin let out the breath he had been holding. Finally! He released the blade, and it burst into mist, which streamed like a tiny river from the hole left behind. Come, he said to his bodyguards, snatching his helm from the rock and walking toward the nearby war camp. As one might expect, the crater edge that formed the war camp wall was most weathered here in the east. The camp had spilled out like the contents of a broken turtle egg, and, over the years, had even started to creep down onto the near plateaus. Emerging from that creep of civilization was a distinctly odd procession. The congregation of robed ardents chanted in unison, surrounding parshmen who carried large poles upright like lances. Silk cloth shimmered between these poles, a good 40 feet wide, rippling in the breeze and cutting off the view of something in the center. Soulcasters? They didn't normally come out during the day. Wait here, he told his bodyguards, then jogged over toward the ardents. The three bridgemen obeyed. If Kaladin had been with them, he would have insisted on following. Maybe the way the fellow acted was a result of his strange position. Why had Father put a dark-eyed soldier outside the command structure? Adolin was all for treating men with respect and honor regardless of eyeshade, but the Almighty had put some men in command and others beneath them. It was simply the natural order of things. The parshmen carrying the poles watched him come, then looked down at the ground. Nearby ardents let Adolin pass, though they looked uncomfortable. Adolin was allowed to see soulcasters, but having him visit them was irregular. Inside the temporary silk room, Adolin found Kadash, one of the foremost of Dalinar's ardents. The tall man had once been a soldier, as the scars on his head testified. He spoke with ardents in blood-red robes. Soulcasters. It was the word for both the people who performed the art and the fabrials they used. Kadash was not one himself. He wore the standard gray robes instead of red, his head shaven, face accented by a square beard. He noticed Adolin, hesitated briefly, then bowed his head in respect. Like all of the Ardents, Kadash was technically a slave. That included the 5 soulcasters. Each stood with right hand to breast, displaying a sparkling fabrial across the back of the palm. One of the Ardents glanced at Adolin. Stormfather, that gaze wasn't completely human. Not any longer. Prolonged use of the soulcaster had transformed the eyes so that they sparkled like gemstones themselves. The woman's skin had hardened to something like stone, smooth, with fine cracks. It was as if the person were a living statue. Kadash hustled over toward Adolin.
"Bright Lord," he said, "I had not realized you were coming to supervise."
"I am not here to supervise," Adolin said, glancing with discomfort at the soulcasters. "I'm just surprised. Don't you usually do this at night?"
"We can't afford to any longer, Bright One," Kadash said. "There are too many demands upon the soulcasters. Buildings, food, removal of waste. To fit it all in, we are going to need to start training multiple Ardents on each fabrial, then working them in shifts. Your father approved this earlier in the week."
This drew glances from several of the red-robed Ardents. What did they think about others training on their fabrials? Their almost alien expressions were unreadable.
"I see," Adolin said. "Storms, we rely on these things a lot."
Everyone talked about shard blades and shard plate, and their advantages in war. But in truth, it was these strange fabrials and the grain they created that had allowed this war to proceed as it had.
"Might we proceed, Bright One?"
Kadash asked. Adolin nodded, and Kadash walked back to the 5 and gave a few brief commands. He spoke quickly, nervous. It was odd to see that in Kadash, who was normally so placid and unflappable. Soulcasters had that effect on everyone. The 5 started softly chanting, a harmony to the singing of the Ardents outside. The 5 stepped forward and raised their hands in a line, and Adolin found his face breaking out in a sweat, blown cold by the wind that managed to sneak past the silken walls. At first, there was nothing. And then, stone. Adolin thought he caught a brief glimpse of mist coalescing, like the moment a shard blade appeared, as a massive wall sprang into existence. Wind blew inward as if sucked by that materializing rock, making the cloth flap violently, snapping and writhing in the air. Why should the wind pull inward? Shouldn't it have been blown outward by rock displacing it? The large barrier abutted the cloth on either side, causing the silk screens to bulge outward and rose high into the air.
"We'll need taller poles," Kadash muttered to himself.
The stone wall had the same utilitarian look as the barracks, but this was a new shape. Flat on the side facing the war camps, it was sloped on the other side, like a wedge. Adolin recognized it as something his father had been deliberating building for months now.
"A windbreak," Adolin said. "That's wonderful, Kadash."
"Yes, well, your father seemed to like the proposal. A few dozen of these out here, and the construction yards will be able to expand onto the entire plateau without fear of high storms."
That wasn't completely true. You always had to worry about high storms, since they could hurl boulders and blow hard enough to rip buildings from their foundations. But a good solid windbreak would be a blessing of the Almighty out here in the Stormlands. The soulcasters retreated, not speaking with the other Ardents. The Parshmen scrambled to keep up, those on one side of the barrier running along behind it with their silk and opening the back of the room to let the new windbreak slip out of the enclosure. They passed by Adolin and Kadash, leaving them exposed on the plateau and standing in the shade of the large new stone structure. The silk wall went back up, blocking sight of the soulcasters. Just before it did, Adolin noticed one of the soulcaster's hands. The fabrial's glow was gone. Likely one or more of the gemstones in it had shattered.
"I still find it incredible," Kadash said, looking up at the stone barrier. "Even after all these years. If we needed proof of the Almighty's hand in our lives, this is certainly it."
A few glory spren appeared around him, spinning and golden. "The Radiance could soulcast,"
Adolin said. Couldn't they?
It is written that they could,
Kadash said carefully. The recreants, the term for the Radiant's betrayal of mankind, was often seen as a failure of Vornism as a religion. The way the Church sought to seize power in the centuries that followed was even more embarrassing. What else could the Radiants do? Adolin asked. They had strange powers, right?
I have not read on it extensively, Bright One, Kadash said. Perhaps I should have spent more time learning about them, if only to remember the evils of pride. I will be certain to do this, Bright One, in order to remain faithful and remember the proper place of all Ardens.
Kadash, Adolin said, watching the shimmering silken procession retreat. I need information right now, not humility. The assassin in white has returned. Kadash gasped.
The disturbance at the palace last night? The rumors are true?
Yes. There was no use hiding it. His father and the king had told the high princes and were planning on how to release the information to everyone else. Adolin met the Arden's eyes. That assassin walked on the walls as if the pull of the earth were nothing to him. He fell 100 feet without injury. He was like a void-bringer, death given form. So I ask you again, what could the Radiants do? Were abilities like these ascribed to them?
Those and more, Bright One,
Kadash whispered, face drained of color.
I spoke with some of the soldiers who survived that first terrible night when the old king was killed. I thought the things they claimed to have seen the result of trauma.
I need to know, Adolin said. Look into it. Read. Tell me what this creature might be capable of doing. We have to know how to fight him. He will return.
Yes,
Kadash said, visibly shaken.
But, Adolin, if what you say is true, storms, it could mean the Radiants are not dead.
I know.
Almighty preserve us,
Kadash whispered.
Navani Kolin loved war camps. In ordinary cities, everything was so messy. Shops where they hardly belonged, streets that refused to run in straight lines. Military men and women, however, valued order and rationality. At least, the better ones did. Their camps reflected that. Barracks in neat rows, shops confined to marketplaces, as opposed to popping up on every corner. From her vantage atop her observation tower, she could see much of Dalinar's camp. So neat, so intentional. This was the mark of humankind, to take the wild, unorganized world and make something logical of it. You could get so much more done when everything was in its place, when you could easily find what or whom you needed. Creativity required such things. Careful planning was indeed the water that nourished innovation. She took in a deep breath and turned back toward the engineering grounds, which dominated the eastern section of Dalinar's war camp. All right, everyone, she called. Let's give it a try. This test had been planned long before the assassin's attack, and she decided to proceed. What else was she going to do? Sit around and worry? The grounds below became a buzz of activity. Her elevated observation platform was perhaps 25 feet high and gave her a good view of the engineering grounds. She was flanked by a dozen different Ardents and scholars, and even Matane and a few other storm wardens. She still wasn't sure what she thought of those fellows. They spent too much time talking about numerology and reading the winds. They called it a science in an attempt to dodge Vorin prohibitions of predicting the future. They had offered some useful wisdom from time to time. She'd invited them for that reason, and because she wanted to keep an eye on them. The object of her attention, and the subject of today's test, was a large circular platform at the center of the engineering yards. The wooden structure looked like the top of a siege tower that had been cut off and laid on the ground. Crenellations ringed it, and they'd set up dummies at those, the kinds that the soldiers used for archery practice. Next to that grounded platform was a tall wooden tower with a latticework of scaffolding up the sides. Workers scuttled over it, checking that everything was operational.
"You really should read this, Navani," Rushu said, looking over a report. The young woman was an ardent and had no right whatsoever to have such lush eyelashes or delicate features. Rushu had joined the Ardentia to escape the advances of men. A silly choice, judging by the way male ardents always wanted to work with her. Fortunately, she was also brilliant, and Navani could always find a use for someone brilliant.
"I'll read it later," Navani said in a gently chiding voice. "We have work to do now, Rushu."
"Changed even when he was in the other room," Rushu mumbled, flipping to another page.
"Repeatable and measurable. Only flame spren so far, but so many potential other applications."
"Rushu," Navani said, a little more firmly this time.
"The test?"
"Oh, sorry, Brightness." The woman tucked the folded pages into a pocket of her robes. Then she ran a hand across her shaved head, frowning. "Navani, have you ever wondered why the Almighty gave beards to men, but not women? For that matter, why do we consider it feminine for a woman to have long hair? Should not more hair be a masculine trait? Many of them have quite a lot of it, you see."
"Focus, child," Navani said. "I want you watching when the test happens."
She turned to the others.
"That goes for all of you. If this thing crashes to the ground again, I don't want to lose another week attempting to figure out what went wrong." The others nodded, and Navani found herself growing excited, some of the tension from the night's attack finally bleeding away. She went over the protocols for the test in her head. People moved out of danger, ardents on various platforms nearby, watching intently with quills and paper to record, stones infused. Everything had been done and checked three times over. She stepped up to the front of her platform, holding the railing tightly with free hand and gloved safe hand, and blessed the Almighty for the distracting power of a good fabrial project. She'd used this one at first to divert herself from worrying about Jasna, though she'd eventually realized that Jasna would be fine. True, reports now said the ship had been lost with all hands, but this wasn't the first time that supposed disaster had struck Navani's daughter. Jasna played with danger as a child played with a captive Kremling, and she always came through.
The assassin's return, though. Oh, Stormfather. If he took Dalinar as he had Gavilar.
"Give the signal," she said to the Ardents. "We've checked everything more times than is useful."
The Ardents nodded and wrote via span read to the workers below. Navani noticed with annoyance that a figure in blue shard plate had wandered onto the engineering grounds, helm under arm, exposing a messy mop of blonde hair speckled black. The guards were supposed to have kept people out, but such prohibitions would not apply to the High Prince's heir. Well, Adolin would know to keep his distance, she hoped. She turned back to the wooden tower. Ardents at the top had activated the fabrials there and now climbed down the ladders at the sides, unhooking latches as they went. Once they were down, workers carefully pulled the sides away on their rollers. Those were the only things that had been holding the top of the tower in place. Without them, it should fall. The top of the platform, however, remained in place, hanging impossibly in the air. Navani's breath caught. The only thing connecting it to the ground was a set of two pulleys and ropes, but those offered no support. That square, thick section of wood now hung in the air completely unsupported. The Ardents around her murmured in excitement. Now for the real test. Navani waved, and the men below worked the cranks on the pulleys, pulling down the floating section of wood. The archer parapet nearby shook, wobbled, then began to rise into the air in a motion exactly opposite to the squares.
"It's working!" Rushu exclaimed.
"I don't like that wobble," said Falilar.
The ancient engineer scratched at his ardent's beard.
"That ascent should be smoother."
"It's not falling," Navani said. "I'll settle for that."
"Wind's willing. I'd have been up there," Rushu said, raising a spyglass. "I can't even see a sparkle from the gemstones. What if they're cracking?"
"Then we'll find out eventually," Navani said. Though, in truth, she wouldn't have minded being on top of the rising parapet herself. Dalinar would have had a heart attack if he'd learned of her doing such a thing. The man was a dear, but he was a touch overprotective, in the way a high storm was a touch windy. The parapet wobbled its way upward. It acted as if it were being hoisted, though it had no support at all. Finally, it peaked. The square of wood that had been hanging in the air before was now down against the ground and tied in place. The round parapet hung in the air instead, slightly off kilter. It did not fall. Adolin clomped up the steps to her viewing platform, rattling and shaking the entire thing with that shard plate of his. By the time he reached her, the other scholars were chattering among themselves and furiously making notes. Logic spren in the shape of tiny storm clouds rose around them. It had worked. Finally.
"Hey," Adolin said. "Is that platform flying?"
"And you only just now noticed this, dear?" Navani asked. He scratched his head.
"I've been distracted, Aunt."
"Huh. That's really odd." He seemed troubled.
"What?"
Navani asked him.
It's like
him. The assassin, who had, according to both Adolin and Dalinar, somehow manipulated gravity spren. Navani looked to the scholars.
"Why don't you all go down and have them lower the platform? You can inspect the gemstones and see if any broke."
The others heard it as a dismissal and went down the steps in an excited bunch, though Rushu, dear Rushu, remained.
"Oh," the woman said, "it would be better to watch from up here in case—"
"I will speak with my nephew. Alone, please." Sometimes, working with scholars, you had to be a touch blunt. Rushu finally blushed, then bobbed a bow and hastened away. Adolin stepped up to the railing. It was difficult to not feel dwarfed by a man wearing plate, and when he reached out to hold the railing, she thought she could hear the wood groan from the strength of that grip. He could have snapped that rail without a second thought. "I will figure out how to make more of that," she thought. While she was no warrior, there might be things she could do to protect her family. The more she understood the secrets of technology and the power of spren locked within gemstones, the closer she grew to finding what she sought. Adolin was staring at her hand.
"Oh, so he'd finally noticed that, had he?"
"Aunt," he said, voice strained. "A glove?"
"Far more practical," she said, holding up her safe hand and wiggling the fingers. "Oh, don't look like that. Dark-eyed women do it all the time."
"You're not dark-eyed."
"I'm the Dowager Queen," Navani said. "Nobody cares what in damnation I do. I could prance around completely nude, and they'd all just shake their heads and talk about how eccentric I am."
Adolin sighed, but let the matter drop, instead nodding toward the platform.
"How did you do it?"
"Conjoined fabrials," Navani said. "The trick was finding a way to overcome the structural weaknesses of the gemstones, which succumb easily to the multiplied strain of simultaneous infusion drain and physical stress. She trailed off as she caught Adolin's eyes glazing over. "He was a bright young man when it came to most social interactions.
but he didn't have a single scholarly breath in him. Navani smiled, switching to layman's terms. If you split a fabrial gemstone in a certain way, Navani said, you can link the two pieces together so they mimic each other's motions. Like a span reed?
Ah, right, Adolin said.
Well, Navani said, we can also make two halves that move opposite one another. We filled the floor of that parapet with such gemstones and put their other halves in the wooden square. Once we engage them all so they are mimicking one another in reverse, we can pull one platform down and make the other go up.
Huh, Adolin said. Can you make this work on a battlefield?
That was, of course, the exact thing Dalinar had asked when she'd shown him the concepts. Proximity is a problem right now, she said. The farther the pairs grow from one another, the weaker their interaction, and that causes them to crack more easily. You don't see it with something light like a span reed, but when working with heavy weights... Well, we can probably get them working on the shattered planes. That's our goal right now. You could roll one of these out there, then engage it and write back to us via reed. We pull the platform here down, and your archers get raised up 50 feet to gain a perfect archery position. This, finally, seemed to get Adolin excited.
The enemy wouldn't be able to topple it or climb it. Stormfather! The tactical advantage!
Exactly.
You don't sound enthusiastic.
I am, dear, Navani said. But this isn't the most ambitious idea we've had for this technique. Not by a faint breeze or a storm wind. He frowned at her. It's all very technical and theoretical right now, Navani said, smiling. But just wait. When you see the things the Ardents are imagining...
Not you? Adolin asked.
I'm their patron, dear, Navani said, patting him on the arm. I don't have time to make all of the diagrams and figures, even were I up to the task. She looked down at the gathered Ardents and women scientists who were inspecting the floor of the parapet platform. They suffer me.
Surely it's more than that,